Good to be with you all tonight. Last night in watching the clock while we were talking about the 14th chapter, I think I forgot to read the chapter. I've been trying to read before we talk about it, but we talked about two-thirds of the chapter last night, so I guess I don't need to read that part, but I'll start in verse 14 and read the remainder of chapter 14. Revelation 14:14. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, Thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. That's the last few verses of chapter 14. And we're ready to talk just briefly about these two harvest scenes. Chapter 14 is the end of the little scroll message. It's the summation of what the Lord wanted us to say in this supplementary material, and it's written to give comfort to those who have just heard the message of chapter 13 about the great beast from the earth that was going to make war against the saints of God. This passage I just read concludes the little scroll with these two harvest scenes. There's a wheat harvest and a grape harvest. And in both scenes, there is a sharp sickle. There is a reference to the harvest being withered or dried up or overripe in the pejorative sense, it would seem, according to the original language here. The two harvest scenes appear to be an expanding on a passage in the Old Testament in Joel chapter 3, verses 12 through 16. This is the only Old Testament text where the sickle is included in the harvest metaphor. In the book of Joel, both the harvest and the treading of the winepress are figures for the judgment of the wicked, and that seems to be the case here in Revelation as well. In Joel, it was said, Swing the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Again, a word referring to premature desiccation. Come, trample the grapes, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness. Joel chapter 3, verse 13. So verses 14 through 20 here in Revelation 14 also refer to the judgment of the wicked, and primarily in terms of the judgment of those who have worshipped the beast. That's the context here. The grapevine is the symbol of God's covenant nation. We see this in the 80th Psalm. We also see it in the 5th chapter of the book of Isaiah. So it's used to point to an apostate church. The expression Son of Man is used here. This was a Semitic expression. An idiom, really, meaning a human being, but it alludes, I'm sure, to Daniel 7:13, when it, the context there where Son of Man is used, and probably it had become a messianic title by the time of Jesus. John 12:34 may point us that way. We do know that Jesus used this designation, Son of Man, as the most common way that he referred to himself, the most common way by far that he referred to himself. It indicates both his identification with humanity as well as his messianic office. The crown of gold is the laurel wreath crown, again, worn by victors, and it indicates the Lord's victory over Babylon. Great deal of time has passed. Babylon was seeming to prevail for hundreds of years, but now the Lord is victorious over it. The sickle was used as a common tool for harvesting. The word sharp speaks of the speed and efficiency with which this harvest was made. The altar is the symbol of sacrifice and therefore speaks of the justice of God. There wouldn't need to be any sacrifice if it were not for God's justice that's going to come because of sin. This reminds us of the fifth seal, again, back in chapter 6, where the souls of the martyrs cried out for God to avenge their deaths. "How long, O Lord, will it be until you punish them for killing us?" they said. At that time, they were instructed to wait, the word is literally to rest, until the number of their fellow servants who were to be killed had been completed, in chapter 6, verse 11. So the first century reader would have understood this to refer to those who were going to be martyred, not under the pagan Roman persecution that they were living under, but in that future time that the first martyrs had been told to rest until. They would understand, even in the first century, that this was going to be under the Antichrist eighth head of the beast that we were talking about last night in chapter 13. We distinguish these martyrs from others because Revelation focuses on that eighth head of the Roman beast and its war with God's people. You and I should never underestimate the inviolability of the holiness of God. We should never underestimate the severity of His wrath as it is held in store for the unfaithful and the ungodly. You and I have never seen anything yet to compare with the judgment of God. This wine press is expressed as being outside the city in verse 20. This reference to the idea of the city of Jerusalem here. But the stadia that are mentioned here, that 1600 stadia, equals a period, a expanse of about 180 to 184 miles. There's been a lot of conjecture as to what this may be referring to. And in the context of God's judgment of the Roman beast, I think probably the best guess on that is that it's referring to what we used to call the papal states, the ones that the Pope was the direct king of. And they went clear across the Italian peninsula. It stretched across there for about 180 miles. So, and this is part of what was taken away from him during the time of the fall of Babylon. So that may be a thought as to what this would be referring to. This battle is mentioned again in the seven sealed scroll under the sixth bowl in chapter 16. We should be able to get to chapter 16 in just a few minutes. I don't know if we'll get to that part of it or not. The harvest scenes forecast the end-time harvest and the judgment of the wicked, and they provide an end to the message of the little scroll. They give it a conclusion that's fitting, and then they return us, as readers, to the interrupted sequence of the seals and the trumpets and the bowls of wrath, and of course of those, only the bowls of wrath remain now. Chapter 15 links us back to chapter 11, verse 19, where we took that detour to talk about the beast in chapter 12 and 13. So chapter 15, verse 1 reads almost the same as 11, 19, about the lightnings and so forth. So all we have left now of this portion is the little introduction in chapter 15, and then all seven bowls of wrath are in chapter 16. Let me just read chapter 15, and we'll say just a little bit about it before getting to chapter 16. "And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened, and the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. And one of the four beasts, or living creatures, gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no man was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled." Only eight verses here, and a pretty straightforward introduction to chapter 16. The seven bowls are the third and final series of judgments which govern the general chronological structure of the seven sealed scroll that was presented back in chapter 5. Each one of these series focuses on a particular stage in the ongoing life of the fourth beast of Daniel, which is Rome. The seals, remember, that we saw in chapter 6 point forward to the fall of paganism. Then the trumpets showed the fall of the Christian Roman Empire, done by the barbarians in the west, and then 1,000 years later done by the Muslims in the east. With the fall of that old imperial system, the Roman beast lay dead, and the little scroll chronicled the resurrection of this Roman beast under its eighth head, Papal Rome. The little scroll forecasts the elevation of this resurrected Roman beast to great power with which it wars against God's people, leading to the judgments that are going to follow in chapter 16. From the supplementary little scroll, we can understand the meaning of the beast. We saw something about his origin and his career, his image, his seat, his adherents, all referred to in the course of the vials, too, looking back at all that. These judgments together, I believe, are called the third woe. Chapter 15 is just the introduction to these bowls of wrath, and as I said, connects back to chapter 11, verse 19. The seven last plagues. Last because in them the wrath of God is completed. We see at the beginning of this here a proleptic scene of resurrected saints, a celebration that's introduced in advance to give hope to a suffering church, believers who in the late first century were being persecuted and needed these words of hope. The songs of Moses and the Lamb reminds us that there is no conflict between the two testaments of God, the Old Testament and the New, of God's Word. Back in Exodus chapter 15, a song of Moses there was sung after a deliverance from bondage. We also have a song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. The victory expressed in song is not going to be able to be completely realized until the bold judgments have been poured out. The glory that's reflected in the sea of luminescent glass is also mixed with fire here, which I think is an important point. This may be volcanic type imagery. We've all seen, on television at least, we've seen the glowing liquefaction of molten lava as it pours down a hillside, and when it hits something flammable, flames will spring up from the side. We've all seen that at least through our television sets. It just breaks forth continually in fire from the mass. And there's an earthquake that accompanies this as well here in this picture that we're given in chapter 15. An earthquake accompanied the seventh trumpet, and we'll see the same imagery under the last vial, the seventh vial, at the end of chapter 16. Revelation focuses on the rule and the destiny of the beast in response to the concerns of the original readers of the first century. The power of this apocalyptic language to speak for itself, even irrespectively of what we think the fulfillment is in the predicted events, is a fact recognized by most people who read this book. It's just quite a piece of work, whether you understand it or not. And it's fitting to read it and try to understand it. The bowls that are mentioned here, which are called vials in the King James, I want to try to call them bowls because I think that conveys to us in our time a better understanding of what they really were. Probably they were the shallow, broad, saucer-shaped bowls or basins that were used in both the tabernacle and the temple to carry coals, live coals of fire, from one altar to the other, and also to dispose of the coals. The reason they're called vials in the King James Version is because the Greek word actually is phile, or the word that corresponds to our English word vial. But I don't know about you. When I think of a vial, I think of maybe a little beaker that has a closed or tight neck where you can just pour out a little bit, like you might use it to pour vinegar on a bowl of spinach or something, that type of thing. That's not what's intended here. These are bowls that are flat, pretty flat and broad, and they were used by the priest to toss or scatter or fling the burning coals out from these bowls, splashing them and splaying them across the ground. That's the idea here. When you pour out one of these bowls of wrath, the whole content goes out, and it goes out and hits with a splat. It's not something you just pour a little bit out of a beaker. One of the living creatures gave the bowls to the seven angels, reflecting the earthly orientation of the bowl judgments. God is punishing his apostate people. The die is cast. It cannot be altered at this point. So prayer to restrain the wrath of God at this point would have no effect. Remember when Jerusalem was about to be destroyed. Jeremiah was told, don't pray for it. There's no point in you praying for it because my mind is already made up. There's been enough time go by where people have had opportunity to repent. The same was certainly true at this time. And I think that's why it says nobody could enter the sanctuary. Nobody could go in prayer and get this altered. These seven plagues are called the last. This is one of the reasons, we talked about this a little bit on Sunday, this is one of the reasons why these cannot run parallel with the previous history. They must come after it or else they could not be called the last. They run consecutively from the seals through the trumpets and finally to the bowls. In chapter 10, verse 7, the angel spoke about the seventh trumpet as that in which God's mystery was to be finished. And that's why I think this seventh trumpet contains the seven bowls. The seventh trumpet contains the seven bowls in the same way that the seventh seal opened up and showed the seven trumpets. So it's a very intricately woven program of God's revelation. The finishing trumpet cannot fail to include or run parallel with these vials, which are the last plagues, because it opens them up. And in a sense, this is the seventh trumpet that blows all through these seven vials of wrath. The seventh seal was developed under the seven trumpets, and the seventh and last of the woe trumpets is developed under the seven vials. The vials are the primary content of the last trumpet, in other words. But the material in chapter 17 and the material in chapter 21, verse 9, are also said to be given by one of these vial angels also. So it may be that the vial era stretches out a ways beyond the end of chapter 16. I think that's perfectly possible. There's a resemblance in these plagues we're going to read about in chapter 16 to the plagues of Egypt that were inflicted to compel the release of God's people from the Pharaoh there. Papal Christendom is figurative Egypt, and God's apostate people were in bondage there. I think with that we can take a look at chapter 16 and the bowls of wrath themselves. The fact that allusive reference is made here to the plagues of Egypt, like we have sores and we have water turned to blood, we have hail, is not as helpful as it might at first appear in determining the figurative meaning of the language here, because the Egyptian plagues were literal, and these plagues in chapter 16 are symbolic. They use the literal plagues of Egypt in six cases or so to describe something that's symbolic. So they don't help us know too much what events are being referred to, although they will help us understand the type of event that is referred to. The general meaning of the parallel to the ten plagues is that God will deliver his true people as he did the Israelites from Egypt. Again, the first century reader would have understood that the beast was a future Roman government and that it needed to be judged because of all the years of persecution it had done of God's people. The judgment of God is never capricious. It's never arbitrary. It's never a knee-jerk reaction. The judgment of God is always an expression of his considered justice and righteous nature. God's holiness and justice requires blood for blood. And the prediction is that he's going to end the temporal power of the little horn. The seventh trumpet with its seven bowls addresses a time after the sounding of the sixth trumpet. Each bowl, after being poured out, continues to act even though other bowls are being poured out too. You got a splat over here and then a splat over there. And the first splat, the consequences of that, the effect of it, are still going on while you have the next bowl poured out. And especially in the first four, these come very quickly together. The judgments of the preceding bowls overrun into the succeeding ones. Okay, I think rather than read this whole chapter, since I'm awful afraid we won't get it done tonight, I'll just read a verse or so at a time as we come to it, and then we'll see how far we can get. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth. God's great voice speaks here. He sends these angels on their ways to their separate missions. Details of succeeding blows by which the temporal power of the papacy was going to fall. That's the context here. Let's read about the first bowl. It's just verse 2. And the first went and poured out his vial upon the earth. And there fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men which had the mark of the beast and upon them which worshipped his image. Now, this first bowl is on the earth as opposed to the sea, the rivers, or the sun. The word noisom, which I read in the King James Bible, just means it's terrible, it's bad. And it has to do with a sore or a boil. This was the sixth Egyptian plague, as you know. And you've all had a boil, most likely at some point in your life. It's a sore that gradually and painfully festers from the inside of you until it eventually erupts at skin level toward the outside of you. In other words, and this is, I think, an important point here to determine what is meant, it is an eruption from within, not an infliction from without. The outbreak of this ulcer from the deep-seated disease within erupted in the 18th century French Revolution. Several factors contributed to this, and since it was such an important event, a series of events really, but since it was such an important time, we need to think a bit about what caused it, because there's always a cause for a boil, and it's deep-seated within you, and when it starts, you don't really know it's starting until it gets to a certain point where it attracts your attention. One of the things that was wrong in the French society was the decadence of that time, and especially the growing moral and spiritual decadence of the papacy and the apostate church as a whole during the centuries leading up to this. Temporal and spiritual authority rested in the papal throne. This had been buttressed with a forged document known as the Donation of Constantine. In this forged imperial decree, Constantine supposedly transferred authority over Rome and the Western Roman Empire to the Pope. Now, this Donation of Constantine was probably composed in the 8th century, and as you know, Constantine died in the 4th century, so obviously Constantine couldn't have had anything to do with this, but it was used a lot in the 13th century to support claims of papal political authority. And the fact that it was eventually exposed in the 15th century as a forgery really didn't matter, because by then it had long since done its job. The vice, the flagrant sins, and the public crimes of the popes in the last half of the 15th century and the early part of the 16th were just blatant. Pope Alexander VI, from 1492 to 1503, secured the papal office through bribery. He fathered several illegitimate children. He conducted bacchanalian orgies right there in the papal palace. We're talking about an apostate system that was rotten and putrid to the core. The license which expressed itself in the accumulation of great wealth through the sale of spiritual favors and indulgences was off-putting to many people who saw it. Many people at this time began to dismiss the Christian religion as unauthentic and false because they were looking at the papacy, and if this reflected Christianity to them, that was identical with Christianity, and they just couldn't believe that it could possibly be true. Many other people took the papal example as license for their own immoral or violent behavior. So the decadence of that society was one thing that contributed to the French Revolution. A second thing was the persecution that we've already talked about in some detail. The extreme atrocities authorized by and committed by the Roman Church with its persecution and slaughter of dissenting Christians and Jews and other people too, but primarily it was dissenting Christians. This turned people against religion and against belief in God. No system of thought has created more atheism than the Roman Catholic apostasy itself. The main victims of this persecution were believers in Christ who rejected the papal claims and doctrines as unbiblical. The doctrines of these groups, as I've mentioned a time or two before, were commonly misrepresented by the authorities to enhance the allegations of heresy. In other words, it was more palatable to kill these people if you made up several things about them that they didn't really believe or practice. The victims were subjected to extreme forms of torture to induce them to recant. Many of them were burnt at the stake. We've mentioned that the names derived from the names of their leaders or their locations geographically or were given to them by their enemies in some way. But some of these names we've mentioned before, the Waldenses, the Albigensians, the Polisians, the Poor Men of Lyons, the Bohemian Brethren, the Wickliffites, the Taborites, the Calixtines, the Valences, the Vaudois, the Hussites, and you could go on and on with various names that were used, but in some cases at least, they refer to themselves as churches of Christ, and we can prove that with documentary evidence. The savage treatment of millions of people contributed to the anti-religious Enlightenment spirit which developed during these centuries. And that brings us to the Enlightenment itself. The growing popularity of the Enlightenment philosophies with their humanistic atheism and materialistic science and anti-Christian thought had a very marked effect during this time, especially in France and Western Europe during these centuries. This was the time of Thomas Paine and David Hume and Edward Gibbon and Bolingbroke in England and Frederick the Great in Germany and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin in our own country. The writings of Descartes and Locke and Voltaire and Rousseau produced a spirit of independence from traditional institutions of both church and state. Rationalism encouraged the enthronement of human reason and discouraged belief in God and divine revelation. These trends encouraged rebellion against the absolutism of church and state and eventually broke out in the French Revolution. Now, France had always been the kingpin of papal power. The King of France was actually known to the popes as the eldest son of the church. And to a considerable degree, the state of Europe was determined by the condition of France. Napoleon said that a revolution in France is sooner or later followed by a revolution in Europe. And that was true. It was said that Paris is the navel of the world. It was centrally located, and culture came out from that, that people looked to Paris to set the fashions in both dress, food, and thought. The central location of France as a nation had something to do with its power. In direct relation to all the purposes and aims of the papacy, they had to have France on their side. And it made it probable that any account of the downfall of the papal power was going to have France included in it. France would not be overlooked in that. I don't know, a lot of people don't know this, but the popes actually lived in Avignon, France. When they got run out of Rome, they actually lived in France for the better part of a century, from 1309 to 1377. All seven popes during those years were French, as were 111 of the 134 cardinals in the College of Cardinals during those years. So France had the mark of the beast as much as any nation on the face of the earth. The French Revolution is largely traceable to the corruptions of the papal Roman system. Apostasy from the faith always contains the germ of its own punishment. The national atheism, the licentiousness, the bloodthirstiness of the French Revolution were just the translation into action of the corrupt moral and social and political and religious principles that had infected the nation for a long time. This boil had been developing for a long time before anybody realized it, and then eventually it came and erupted. Reason revolted at the incredible dogmas that superstitious Roman Catholics were asked to believe. Moral sense revolted at the cruelties and oppressions of the papal system. Infidelity, unbelief in God, was the nursing offspring of that system. Indulgence was shown toward atheism and infidelity as long as the people still outwardly conformed to the system. Didn't really matter to them what you actually believed as long as you pretended that you believed in the papal system. But infidelity continued to grow and grow in the hearts of the people until eventually its hatred of God impelled it to become aggressive. And when it got aggressive and came out in the open, it was like the lid blowing off of a pressure cooker. You may have seen that happen in your kitchen one time or the other, where it just flies up and hits the ceiling and spins around for a while before it comes back down because of the tremendous pressure that built up. Some of these other nations we've talked about had a reformation to take some of the pressure off. France didn't have a reformation because it had Louis XIV, who didn't allow a reformation. He was king for 73 years and ruled with an absolutely iron hand. So they never had a reformation, so eventually the lid just blew off of everything. What had festered and inflamed like a boil broke out in violent war in 1789. The French Revolution was a tremendous outbreak of social and moral fury and atheism and vice. From France as the center, it spread like a plague throughout Europe to the other countries of papal Christendom. This event was of major importance for the world. We're not talking about something that was done in a corner here. Edmund Burke, writer in his Reflections on the Revolution in France and also his Letters on a Regicide Peace, used expressions like fever and epidemic and corruptions to describe the French Revolution. He used the expression malignant French distemper, and he called it a plague. Burke also called the French Revolution the most astonishing event in human history. But it interests me that he used this same type of terminology as the Bible uses to predict this when John was writing way back in the first century. He called it the most astonishing event in human history, and that's a rather remarkable thing to say. The Age of Reason was declared. There was a calculated and determined attack on the Bible. There was a crusade against all religion in France. Notre Dame Cathedral became the Temple of Reason. A statement was made by Goethe, the writer, on September the 20th, 1792, that here and now begins a new epoch in world history. And this was really, in a sense, true. Christian funeral services were abolished. Cemeteries were forced to display the inscription, "Death is an eternal sleep." The French nation actually declared itself atheistic, and papal power received a shock from which it never recovered and never will recover, never can recover. The effects were just devastating for the Roman Catholic Church. Its sources of revenue were undermined. Its control over its diocese was lost. Its property was confiscated. The atrocities that had been formerly committed by the Roman Church against the heretics were now done to the papal priests themselves. What goes around came around. Purposefully copied all too faithfully. The same persecutions that they used to do to the saints were now done to them on purpose by a generation so ignorant of even the first elements of the Christian faith as found in the Bible that they couldn't have told you what they were. There were shootings, drownings, roastings, and we could go on and on with that. The symbol of verse 2 of a previously existing corruption within that broke out in ulceration is amply fulfilled in the French Revolution. Horrors and sufferings rose out of the national atheism and licentiousness and bloodthirstiness of spirit. They were the evolution into violent action of the corruptions that had existed for a long time in that nation, and that had been infused as a part of Rome's religious system by the papal beast that nation worshipped. The revolution was aimed at the power of the papacy. In 5 years, 2 million people were put to death, including 24,000 priests. Just put to death. These priests that had been so respected and so glorified, 24,000 of them were put to death. 40,000 church houses were turned into stables for horses. The power of the popes in France was shattered, and it was determined to spread the revolution to other countries. A new calendar was adopted in 1793. They backdated it to 1792, the first year of the French Republic, but they didn't develop this calendar till 1792. They got rid of the old calendar because the old calendar was based on the birth of the Lord. They didn't want anything to do with the birth of the Lord. They didn't want anybody reminded of the birth of the Lord when they said what year it was. So they just started over again with the year one to have a natural view of things. They looked out at the natural world, and instead of anything supernatural, they named everything after the natural world. Every day of the year was given a name of its own from either a plant or an animal or something in the natural world. And when they came to name December 25th, now you and I know that Jesus most likely was not born on December 25th. It's possible that he was, but also possible that he was born on about any other day of the year. We evidently do not need to know when he was born, since the Lord has not revealed that to us. Maybe he purposefully didn't reveal it to us so that we wouldn't make an issue out of one particular day. However that may be, the Roman Catholic Church taught then and now, and it was believed by most of its adherents, that Jesus actually was born on December 25th. So when the French revolutionaries came to name that particular day, they made December 25th the day of the dog, just as a little extra insult against the Lord of the universe, whom they no longer believed in. This was a reaction against everything that they had been taught religiously that had anything to do with reality from the Bible, which wasn't that much. They hadn't had that much from the Bible. But anything they could do to remove religion from their culture They did. And if we take 533 as the beginning of the papacy, as we were talking about last night, for the rise of the eighth head, then the 1,260 years ended in 1793. In 1793, King Louis XVI had his head chopped off in January, and his queen, Marie Antoinette, had her head chopped off later that year in October. The monuments of monarchy were destroyed. These monarchies had been in place for a long, long time, absolute monarchies, but now they were destroyed. The kings of the tombs were violated. The tombs of the kings were violated. Church buildings were stripped of the valuable medals in them. The Bishop of Paris was prevailed upon to publicly abjure the Christian faith. A naked prostitute was worshipped as the goddess of reason with accompanying orgies. All the members of the French Convention lived publicly with their mistresses. To have done otherwise would have exposed them to the suspicion of being closet Christians. So they couldn't have that. And half of the births in Paris during these years were illegitimate births. 48,000 revolutionary committees were established in France with a combined membership of over 500,000 people. Each of these people received 3 francs a day as his wages for seeking out victims for arrest and the scaffold so that they could be killed. Paper money was issued incessantly, resulting in a total economic confusion. The power of money rapidly fell to a tenth and soon afterward to a 20th of its face value. Debtors paid their obligations with currency that finally was not worth even 1/100 of its face value. Farmers kept raising the price of their goods to keep up in proportion to the fall in the paper money. And this was just the opposite of what the people of France had been led to expect as the result of the revolution. The revolutionists themselves destroyed each other in rapid succession, repeatedly proving that the noble savage is not noble, he's just savage. During the Reign of Terror, for instance, in 1794, for a few months there, from April to July, there were daily executions in the capital and extermination out in the provinces. Moderates among the revolutionaries perished because they were inferior in wickedness to their opponents. Virtue seemed absolutely powerless at this time. Men were given over to their own reprobate minds. Hundreds and at last thousands were executed daily. People sought to forget their sorrows in a delirium of present enjoyments. All the theaters of Paris were open as usual during the whole Reign of Terror, and they were never fuller, so people could get their minds off the terrible stress that was going on in their civilization. When the nobles and the higher orders of the old society were pretty much all dead, all had their heads chopped off, then the guillotine began to descend on the shopkeepers and the more opulent among the laboring classes, and it was only in reaction to this that an end was put to the Reign of Terror. Meanwhile, war was declared by France against Great Britain. These vials overrun each other, and this is going to have to do with the next vial. Remember, the judgments of one do not necessarily stop when the next one is poured out. So let's look at the next one. This is in verse 3. The second angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and it became as the blood of a dead man, and every living soul died in the sea. So the second bowl is poured out on the sea. I believe this has to do with maritime battles. The sea was turned to blood. Every living thing in the sea died. Has to do with the idea here of the blood of a dead man congealed, turning black. You've all seen occasionally, perhaps, the purplish face of a corpse. The sea would become discolored. The effect of great quantities of blood shed on the waters is indicated here. We should expect that this fulfillment will focus on a time of major maritime battles. There's a likeness between the first four vials or bowls and the first four trumpets. The scene and the subject of each one of these in each case is almost the same: earth, sea, rivers, and sun. But with the trumpets, we're told about 1/3 of the earth, sea, rivers, and sun. In these vials, it seems like the entire thing is being spoken of. The eastern division of the empire, together with the Illyrian portion, had been taken over by the Turkish conquest, as we've seen. It had been annihilated in its political character, in other words. When people were all killed, the idea was that the political character of that area was annihilated. The Eastern Empire was annihilated as a so-called Christian state and became a Muslim state. The third part of men had been killed, symbolically killed, in their collective and political character under the sixth trumpet. Right after that, the rest of the men who were not killed are spoken of. In other words, papal Europe was left as the remaining Christendom of the old Roman earth. The second trumpet prophecy, in that one, only the third of the sea was affected. But here it appears to affect the entire sea. Now back when we were looking at the trumpets in chapter 8, remember Genseric and his Vandals under the second trumpet, they targeted Rome. And here also in these vials, we should expect Rome or papal Christendom will be targeted in this second bowl predicted. The naval predominance of Protestant England had been steadily growing. Now in France, Napoleon is a great warrior. Tremendous military genius, but Napoleon is a land warrior. Napoleon knew everything about the military as long as it was on land. He could design a big gun, he could cast it, he could place every screw in it. Napoleon could repair every wheel and every shaft of any ammunition wagon. He knew when every horse in any cavalry squadron was going to need to be reshod. He knew exactly how much that would cost. He knew exactly how many loaves of bread a field bakery could turn out in a day. Napoleon's prodigious memory and his far-reaching knowledge of military things was one of the secrets of his predominance for such a long time. But in naval matters, Napoleon was an absolute amateur. He wasn't an expert at all. When Napoleon would get out on the sea, he got seasick. And he didn't like to be out there. He didn't even like to have to think in terms of sea battle. He wanted to keep everything on the land as much as he possibly could. And this led him to blunders that were unique in his military career. One example of this, an American inventor by the name of Robert Fulton, whom you've probably heard of at some time in your life as the inventor of the steamship. Robert Fulton came to Paris and offered the French government two new inventions. One of them was a ship propelled by steam instead of by wind, and the other was a submarine that could sink ships with torpedoes. Well, these could have been a great advantage, but Napoleon said that Fulton was a charlatan because he's dealing with naval things. If he had brought Napoleon a machine gun or a field telegraph, Napoleon would have paid him well because those things he can use on the land. Napoleon failed to conquer England because this was the one area in which he was neither competent nor confident. If only he could have gotten to that English island by land, then I do believe that he could have overcome it. But it's an island. We don't always think of it that way so much, maybe, but remember Churchill's statement during the Second World War at the beginning of it. We will defend our island no matter what the cost may be. The people living there in general tend to think of it that way. The Roman Catholic maritime powers of France, Spain, Portugal, and Holland fought against Protestant England, and they were all defeated by Protestant England. And we're told here that every living soul in the sea died, which is the idea of being annihilated in their character as European colonies. Not that every single person died, but it's a symbolic death, the death of that particular area in the character that it had stood for. These wars that arose out of the French Revolution started in 1793 and lasted for more than two decades until 1815. The maritime power of England had been separated for a long time from the papacy. As we saw in chapter 11, the tenth part of the city fell. England dropped out, and we told why at the time of Henry VIII that he wanted to get out of that for more reasons than one, really. And England developed its navy to an extent that really there hadn't been a navy like this ever before, as far as I know. To give you just a little information about this here, in 1793, the greater part of the French fleet at Toulon was destroyed by Lord Hood. This was huge. The French fleet was mainly destroyed. So here you have England with this huge navy, and France got about nothing. In 1794, the victory over the French by Lord Howe off of Ushant, which is a French island at the southeastern end of the English Channel. Also, Corsica was taken. That was Napoleon's home island. But Corsica was taken, and nearly all of the smaller Spanish and French West Indian islands were taken. 1795, Lord Bridport port, the defeat of the French fleet of L'Orient. L'Orient was the flagship of that fleet. There was the taking of the Cape of Good Hope by the English. In 1797, the victory over the Spanish fleet off of Cape St. Vincent and over the French at Camperdown, which is off of Sydney, Australia. In 1798, Lord Nelson's victory of the Nile and the flagship L'Orient, the French flagship herself, was destroyed there. 1801, Lord Nelson's victory at Copenhagen. 1805, Lord Nelson annihilated the French fleet at Trafalgar off of the coast of Spain. Nelson was mortally wounded during that last battle and died 3 hours later, becoming a great British hero. And in Trafalgar Square in central London today, some of you have been there, there's a prominent statue of Lord Nelson. When I went to Israel with Tom Dennis way back in another century, we wouldn't have been over London overnight, but we had an engine problem, so we stayed overnight in London. Some of us went out in a taxi the next day, and we drove around that circle there and saw that statue of Lord Nelson, which some of the rest of you have probably seen also. Eventually, Napoleon himself, at the end of his career, was taken by an English ship. We're talking about English maritime power. Napoleon himself was taken by an English ship to the little island of St. Helena, way out in the middle of the Atlantic. It's farther from anywhere than anywhere else on Earth, so that he couldn't escape. Last time they put him on an island was at Elba off the coast of Italy, and he escaped and went back to France and took over again for 3 months before they defeated him again. So next time they put him out in the middle of the Atlantic, and they had a 24-hour watch on him, and he wasn't going to get off that island. He couldn't even communicate with members of his family. It was quite an extravagant isolation. He lived in exile there for the remainder of his life until he finally died, apparently of stomach cancer at the age of 51. Stomach cancer ran in his family. So his is a very interesting story and has to do with the fulfillment of some of these bold prophecies. In this naval war from 1793 to 1815, there were destroyed nearly 200 ships of the line, between 300 and 400 frigates, and an almost incalculable number of smaller vessels of war and ships of commerce. By this means, the world power of the papacy was greatly weakened. This total destruction of the French marine and commercial power is even more remarkable because Napoleon understood how important this all was, and yet he had an aversion to it and just couldn't convince himself that it really mattered that much, even though he was a genius and he had to understand this on some level. But he seemed to have had a blind spot there. Now think about that. Here you have a military genius with a huge blind spot. He was all-powerful on land where he had to fulfill prophecy, but he was impotent in those things which the Lord's prophecy denied him. It's just a really remarkable career and a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy, both pro and con, with Napoleon. The war resulted in the loss to Papal France of her colonies in the West Indies and in South America, and this was huge commercially. With just one place that they lost, Santo Domingo, which is now Haiti, France had commerce that required 1,600 ships and employed 27,000 sailors, and all this trade was lost to Papal France, plus a whole lot more. Great Britain went into these revolutionary wars a dwarf and came out of them a giant. Okay, the third bowl, verses 4 through 7. This may be the last one we're able to look at. The third bowl poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of waters, and they became blood. I heard the angel of the waters say, "Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art and wast and shall be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of the saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy." And I heard another out of the altar say, "Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments." So this third one is upon the rivers and the springs of water. The rivers mentioned here probably would be primarily the Danube, the Rhine, and the Po, and the literally hundreds of tributaries that fed into these large rivers. Their tributaries and the surrounding territories. We're not just on the rivers here, but to be on a river then was indicative, or be on a river or off a river, just off a river, was indicative of the area right around there. Because these used to be the landmarks. In contrast to the maritime warfare of the Second Bowl, this suggests warfare on land, even though the rivers are given as landmarks. They The rivers were the freeways that people used before we had cars like we do now. Today we say, when we're looking for directions, well, where are you from 65? I said that to somebody this week. Or where are you from I-44? But they used to say, where are you from the Danube? Where are you from the Rhine? Because these were the landmarks. These wars came about as a consequence of the French Revolution. Napoleon saw himself as the orderer of the chaos that was left by the Revolution. He grabbed the power in France, and he used it as his base to try to consolidate a United States of Europe. Instead of the legitimate monarchies and the so-called divine rights of kings, passing down their prerogatives hereditarily from one generation to the next, Napoleon wanted talent to be supreme. And this was true in every case with Napoleon, except where his own family was involved. To them, the no-spoil system was strong enough. He appointed every high office for his brothers to fulfill. Most of them were really not up to the job, and they caused him grief his whole life until he finally got exiled. But he kept doing it because of his love, his Corsican love for his close family. His great goal became to produce an heir who could rule after him, even though he supposedly was not to believe in hereditary monarchy. So it was really weird. He even went so far as to divorce his wife and marry another woman so that he could have an heir who could rule after him. Napoleon had no god but ambition. Napoleon was just as comfortable using the Pope as abusing the Pope, whatever would result in most power for Napoleon. Napoleon could be a Muslim just as easily as he could be a Catholic, if it would help him, as it did down in Egypt. Actually, when you look at his career and you look at the scheme of time in France, it's amazing how little change there actually was from the Bourbons to Napoleon and then later back to the Bourbons again. You're still dealing with a pretty absolute power. It was in the invasion of Italy that Napoleon began his career of victories and first became famous. He launched his first Italian campaign in 1796 in the Alpine areas of northern Italy, Piedmont. Now you can see the Italian boot in white reaching down there into the Mediterranean Sea. The Piedmont area is in red there, and also Lombardy is right beside it. There's Lombardy, there's Piedmont. Those two areas there are where Napoleon's battles were being fought in 1796, his first battles there. And northern Italy is crowded with rivers. You can see a number of the larger rivers on the map there. There's so many rivers because it's a result of rain coming in the Alps or snow melting in the Alps, and this water comes rushing down in torrents that become rivers. The remarkable thing here is that this was the very region where the persecutions against the Waldenses and the Albigensians had been carried on, the valleys of the Piedmont in particular. In the times of papal persecution, these river valleys had been made to flow with the blood of the saints. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. As the bird meets her mate, so justice meets the wrongdoer. God often defers judgment to a later generation of people than the ones who commit the crime. Of course, eternal judgment is coming as well. But as so far as earth is concerned, sometimes these things take a long time to play out. It seems to be a righteous retribution that these desolations of war and these conflagrations, these scenes of carnage, should occur in the very land that was now reddened again with the blood of men slain in battle for murders previously committed against God's saints. Under the fifth seal in chapter 6, the altar there was seen to be the covering tomb of the martyrs sacrificed in the cause of Christ. Their souls were under the altar. And here, that altar is heard speaking. Those murdered by papal Rome are fellow martyrs. They're associated in spirit. They're associated in location with the souls gathered under the same altar from the persecutions of pagan Rome. In 1796, at the age of 27, Napoleon marched his armies southward through Italy and humbled the Italian states and the Pope. Every river was made a battlefield, and every one of his conflicts at that time was on these rivers. So that's what I think this third bowl of wrath is talking about with these rivers. In 1797, the Rhine was subjected to France. The affected regions were all papal states and territories. A blow to the papal power was struck here from which Rome has never been able to recover. Sentiments were diffused by the flavor of liberty from papal authority, which never were going to be able to be fully suppressed again. You couldn't put that genie back in the bottle. And I guess we have to stop there, ready for the fourth bowl. Sorry about that. I would have liked to have gotten all of these bowls covered, because once you get these bowls